All I can get is static or variations on the central musical rhythm.
I only wish there was some way we could tell it to shut up. It's driving me crazy. And it keeps getting louder.
We have no way of estimating the volume this creature can produce.
The only logical solution is to listen to CJSF 90.1 FM. They broadcast from Burnaby Mountain in British Columbia. Let's tune in now.
Quick note that the following episode of Canada Land may contain subject matter and language that some people will find offensive. I don't like guns. I'm sure that they're fun and all, but they mostly exist to kill things. And I'm biased. I have a personal bias against getting killed. And so I've been unmoved by the so-called debate around gun rights. I just tune out. I got to tell you, I don't care much about sports shooters or livestock control or self-defense. I just want less guns. No guns would be totally okay with me. No guns for cops. That sounds good too. Whatever the gun guys have to say, I just find myself thinking that, like, you're making this too complicated. If we got rid of the guns, we would get rid of the gun deaths. Japan, for example, almost no guns there, and almost no gun deaths. Like, around 10 a year. And yes, one of those gun deaths was their former prime minister, who was recently assassinated. So I do take the point that maybe it's impossible to get rid of all the guns. But you can get pretty damn close. And that sounds about right to me. Because, I may have mentioned, I don't like guns. I do not like guns in a boat. I do not like guns with a goat. You get the idea. I don't like them. And I'm not very open to hearing from those who do like them. And I said so on a recent podcast. And I heard back. I heard back from a lot of you, actually. I was surprised by how many gun owners listen to Canada Land. I was unsurprised by how informed and reasonable these people were. There are always people in this listenership who know way more about any given topic than I do. These people in particular, they wrote to me and they asked me to just listen. Just consider that there might be a valid other side to this whole thing. So that's what I'm going to do. Gun owners in Canada are celebrating right now. They just got the Liberal government to scrap a legislative amendment to the Liberals' new gun law, Bill C-21, an amendment which would have made tons of guns illegal, many of them semi-automatic weapons, the guns of choice for mass shooters. On that very day, when the gun guys won that battle to have that amendment scrapped, I spoke to Ian Runkle, a lawyer and gun rights advocate who runs the popular gun guy YouTube channel, Runkle of the Bailey. Today you're going to hear from that conversation, and you will hear from a lawyer who is focused on Indigenous rights. You'll also hear from some of those gun owners who reached out to me, to us, the guys who wanted me to keep an open mind and hear them out. I'll try my best. Wait for it.
My name is Ryan, and I'm an Olds College student. One of the main reasons I got my license was I wanted to get into sport shooting, and now that's kind of been all taken away. I've now fallen into doing some trap shooting and skeet shooting, but that kind of whole spree gun competition has been removed from Canada and been banned. People think that you can just take any old firearm and go into the woods and shoot it. That's not the case. That has been the case for a while. I'm going to say this, like, I enjoy our licensing laws here. Like, I don't want what the U.S. has, but I don't like what we have. Like, I think I like that the red flag laws are there for people who shouldn't have firearms. I like that we have background checks for people who, like, I don't want to prohibit what people can own. I want to prohibit who can own them. Because to me, like, I've been put through the background checks, so I have both my restricted and non-restricted. And if I'm okay to have one firearm, why am I not okay to have another? It feels like there's other ways we could go about gun violence in this country, because I'm scared of it. Like, I see what's going on and I'm terrified of it. But it feels like they're going after the wrong issue. Jesse Brown hit the nail on the head when he said it feels like we're getting gaslit with multiple laws in this country. And when Trudeau came out and said, like, you don't need an AR-15 to bring down a deer, to say a statement like that is so frustrating, because of the fact that not only is that caliber of, like, bullet too small, like, it's .223, which is illegal to hunt deer with because it's not powerful enough to be able to take down a deer humanely, but they're banned. You can only use them out of range anyways. So what, why make a comment like that and set up this entire thing in a poor light?
My name is Ian Runkle. I'm a criminal defense and firearms lawyer. I have a YouTube channel at Runkle of the Bailey.
Ian, what does the change mean for you personally, the government dropping this amendment? Do you have any of the guns that would have been criminalized?
Several. I think it would have been 5 or 6 I would have had to toss out.
Any semi-automatics?
Yeah. So I've got a couple of SKSs. One of them is signed by the guy who played Jane Cobb in Firefly.
Do I have your attention? It's a Callahan full bore auto lock. Customized trigger, double cartridge thorough gauge. It is my very favorite gun. I call it Vera.
Ian, why do you need to go pow, pow, pow? What's the problem with just going pow, pow, pow?
I always say that need is the wrong comparison because we don't apply need to anything else. We don't say what sort of computer do you need. All of these things evolve. We're talking about firearms with modern ergonomics that are that make them more comfortable to shoot and more sort of practical. Semi-automatic has been sort of the common standard. It's very ubiquitous in terms of firearm design for modern designs. It's just it makes sense. The point is, I'm not harming anybody by going target shooting, and these firearms are almost never used in crime.
I mean, that might be true in as much as mass shootings are rare crimes, but they're serious crimes. The Dawson College shooter had 2 legally purchased licensed semi-automatics. The shooter at the École Polytechnique massacre killed 14 women with a legally obtained semi-automatic hunting rifle. 14 women. More recently, the Quebec mosque shooter had 2 semi-automatics, both legal weapons, though the magazine, I understand, in one was illegal. In Portapique, that massacre was taking place with 2 semi-automatic rifles. The rifles themselves are legal in Canada, though the shooter didn't have them legally. And most recently, that guy here in Vaughan, Ontario, who just killed 5 of his neighbors, he reportedly used a semi-automatic. We still don't know how he got it. So when we're talking about mass shootings, it seems like semi-automatic weapons are the weapons of choice for these men who want to go and kill as many people as possible as quickly as possible. Not even getting involved in yet in my position on this or opinion, that would be the why. Why is the government coming for semi-automatics? It's because, and I think this was suggested by the timing of when they announced these amendments, it's because mass shootings take place and they take place with these guns.
Well, if we're talking about the timing, they had these amendments lined up before the shootings.
Oh, yeah, but they could just wait for the next, because there's going to be one, and there will be another one.
This is a bit of a ghoulish activity, because it's intended that they wait for this to do something they wanted to do anyway.
Yeah, but they can only do that cynical political maneuver because there are mass shootings with semi-automatic weapons, which I'll give them benefit of the doubt that they want to stop mass shootings with semi-automatic weapons.
Banning these won't eliminate mass shootings and certainly won't eliminate mass killings. And in fact, firearms, although when you look at the history of mass killings, the most lethal ones don't involve firearms at all. They involve fire. You're not going to stop people like the, Manassian who used a van. And you're not going to necessarily meaningfully affect things. If people are unable to acquire firearms through legal means, these guys are not, they're often portrayed as having snapped, and snapped is the wrong word because typically these things are planned for years ahead of time. And so we see with the ones out east recently, This was somebody who planned things for years and was known to the police to have acquired illegal firearms. And in fact, this is a very common trend that we see where these guys are known to the police. They've had multiple reports in, and that in fact the RCMP and the police have done nothing. And what we end up doing is we get these situations where the police do nothing about people. They have reports repeatedly about being dangerous. And they then proceed to say, well, we did nothing, but now we want more power.
Should the cops have done more in Porto Peak? Yes, they should have. Does that mean that we should not be looking at how easy it might be to get a semi-automatic or whether they should be legal? Like, that's just two separate issues.
They're very much related issues, because if you're going to allow for distraction from what I think is the bigger issue, like, are these powers that they have enough if they were used properly? And I would say, yes, they are. There isn't a need to go after every target shooter and and tons of hunters and so forth, just because the police have failed so spectacularly in some of these circumstances, because Porto Peak could have been stopped.
Yeah, but others couldn't. The reason for these efforts is not simply because cops have failed in that one instance. I don't know what the cops could have done about Bissonnette. And I think that your suggestion, like, well, the killer will just get something else, and we can point to occasions where they've, you know, done it with knives or done it with vans. I think that if you look to the states, the prevalence of very serious weapons of war in homes, readily accessible, handed to people, people's parents having them, and then they have this epidemic of mass shootings all the time. I'm not saying that it's going to stop these types of events, but don't we want to stop as many of them as we can, or slow them down as much as we can?
The epidemic actually started with the media coverage, and the biggest factor that we see is actually the media response to these. And so if we're talking about how are we going to slow this down, that would be a good place to look.
We could look at Canadian law, because gun crime rates in Canada went up every year for 5 years in a row from 2014 to 2019. In 2019, a new gun control bill got royal assent and made it harder for people to get guns. And then the gun crime rate went down by 5% in 2021. And that's the same year that the overall crime rate went up by 4%, but gun crime went down. So it looks like gun control works.
I have never actually seen a drug dealer using like a legally owned firearm. It's just something that doesn't happen. When we talk about gun crime, we have to be very careful as to what kind of statistics we're using. And firearm statistics are an area where you will see a lot of hedging or a lot of fudging. I'm not sure which stat you're using there.
Stats can.
Again, I don't know how they're defining gun crime there.
Crimes in which a firearm was present. That's how they define it.
Okay, so are we talking like storage? Because I have a very different view as to the social implications of somebody who forgets to put a trigger lock on as they, you know, when they're storing something, as I do of somebody who is carrying a gun to go and carry out, say, a gang shooting. That's a very different scenario.
Ian, if that's the case, that they criminalize these very innocuous things of you're not storing it properly, and then the cops are invading people's rights because of the gun control law, then you would see the instance of gun crimes going up. But in fact, it went down since they put this law in place.
You get different enforcement at different periods. This is the problem with some of these statistics, is that they end up being quite faulty in terms of having the discussion.
The law that came into effect in 2019 had to do with screening for gun owners. It tightened up the screening protocols before you could obtain a firearm. And after that, we saw a precipitous drop in gun crime.
And that drop is a regression to the 2018 levels. And before that, in 2015, you can see it was lower. 2013, it was lower. We're talking about some variation over time. I can tell you that that screening tightening will have affected almost very few people. What they basically said is that somebody who had, depression 30 years ago suddenly had to indicate, okay, yes, I was treated for depression 30 years ago when they apply for a firearms license, whereas previously they only had to report it within 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the change.
It got harder, the red tape, and the process became more difficult.
When we're talking about the rate of firearm-related violent crime, the vast, vast majority of that is people without firearms licenses.
I live in a rural area in Newfoundland. I have a license range about 10 minutes from my house. I have access to hunting within walking distance to my house. It's really hard for someone who lives in a major urban center to relate to me. And there's lots of us in the country that use semi-automatic firearms for hunting. There's lots of us that use semi-automatic firearms for sport. Every few years, the government of the day bans firearms. They say, these firearms here, these firearms are awful, they're dangerous, no one should own them. And that's fine. You know, I understand that there are some firearms that we should own. But then a couple of years later, another government takes that list. The first government said, yeah, these firearms are okay. And then they say, no, we've got to ban this selection of firearms. And every couple of years, those goalposts get moved. And either they need a distraction or they have a problem that they can't really solve. And they're going to point to these firearms. And they're going to say, we're going to ban these firearms because they're bad. We already have extremely good gun control in Canada. However, the changes in Bill C-21 don't affect criminals. The changes in Bill C-21 are only targeted towards licensed gun owners. They're only targeted towards people that have already gone and done their safety course. They have a license. They get background checked regularly. They're already subject to transport requirements. They're already subject to storage requirements. My biggest issue with Bill C-21 is that it doesn't in any way affect criminals. It only affects people who are already following the law. If you live in an area, like if you live in a major urban area and you're seeing crime happen in your neighborhood and you're saying to yourself, I want to do something to stop that. And I absolutely understand that desire. But I don't understand how Bill C-21 helps with that, because Bill C-21 is only targeting people who already have a firearms license or are doing things legally. I look at Bill C-21 and I really think that it's a result of the urban-rural divide in Canada.
Okay, I want to talk about that specifically, because that's the main point that I hear from a lot of gun advocates. Why are you picking on me? I am a legitimate user of firearms. I use it for sport. I use it for hunting. Your problem are street criminals who don't follow laws anyhow. I hear that argument, and I think it's a faulty one, because that does cover one category of gun crime, but there is another kind of gun crime, and I accept that it's a much more rare kind of gun crime. But it's a pretty serious one. It's the one I'm actually more concerned about. I'm not really all that worried about being shot in downtown Toronto because I got in the crossfire of some kind of gang war. I am worried about a mass shooter coming into my workplace, my grocery store, my synagogue, my kids' school. And I recognize that happens very infrequently, but it happens a lot in the States, and it does happen in Canada. And some of those cases are people who have no criminal connections, who would not know how to buy a gun on the black market, but often the use case is their dad has a gun, or they're a sport shooter, they're a hunter. So I'm okay with making your hunting experience a little bit more inconvenient or less fun in order to make it that much harder for that one outlier to have the means to kill as many people as quickly as possible in a place where I'm living my life and my family is living their lives. Like that's an okay trade-off for me.
Sure. And do it to Julia has always been a popular approach. You know, everybody is not concerned with the rights and interests of people who are unlike them and who like different things. This is why it is typically very easy to oppress small groups.
You're not oppressed. I'm not saying that I don't care. I'm actually recognizing that you do have an interest. It's like individual to individual, hunters are saying, look, I know that I'm not going to be the next Portapique guy. Leave me alone. And I'm like, you know what, Ian, I believe you that your gun is never going to be used in a mass shooting. But if I'm looking at 1,000 guys like you, I don't feel as confident, because I know statistically that once we reach a certain number, maybe it's 10,000, one of you will be that guy who snaps, or your gun will be used by one of those people who snaps. So yes, I am saying you're going to have to make a sacrifice of some level of convenience, because the rest of us have a much stronger interest in like breathing.
The issue is that when we look at the numbers of people who are killed in mass shootings, pre-Columbine, and Columbine had a tremendous effect because of the media coverage. It basically doubled the number of these sort of shootings in the States. And that's because these killers very much look at the media coverage and they build on that.
The government can make it so that there are a lot fewer semi-automatic rifles around. That is something that is feasible. And I don't think it's irrational to think that that's going to have an impact on these types of crimes.
I mean, what do you do to protect yourself from lightning when you go outside?
I mean, if your position is there's nothing we can do because it's just like lightning, if that's the position, that what you're saying is, f*** it. There's nothing that can be done about this. It's just going to happen.
No, you're mischaracterizing my position entirely. When we're talking about the comparison to lightning, it's because lightning kills about as many people as, or at least pre-Columbine, the rate of your likelihood of dying in the States in one of those events was equivalent to your likelihood of dying from a lightning strike. The media contagion effect has had an impact in the States, and a substantial one. But I think that part of the way of dealing with that is having a more responsible way of covering those things in the same way that they have a more responsible way of covering suicides. The media changed how they covered suicides in response to the fact that it was discovered that there was strong contagion effects. It has been now studied that we see similar contagion effects with respect to these mass killings. And so the problem that we end up with is that these things end up being the sort of a focus, that they become the only thing on the news for a substantial period. And we go into these deep dives on, you know, who did it in this very public way. And so you've got people who largely feel anger and not heard and, you know, helplessness. And I'm not trying to say that these are, that we should have sympathy necessarily for these individuals, but it is important to understand where they're coming from, what is motivating them. And so they really want to sort of get that out there. And basically for this certain small, because this is always a terribly tiny portion of the population, which is one of the things that makes it difficult to sort of study these people. But when you end up with this, you're sort of giving them what they want, and you're providing a path to them to get something that they don't have otherwise. And so, for example, there's a campaign of to try to not name these shooters, to prevent them from getting infamy. Because when you actually look at Manassian, I've got a video series where I went through his interrogation, but Manassian went through and actively cited several other people as inspirations. And in fact, you see lots of these guys cite these people as their heroes. When you see, you know, Virginia Tech, there was similar aspects of people referencing, lots of people reference Columbine. And I don't really know how we deal with this, but I think we need to look at this. And I think the push to try to keep people's names sort of out of it and to stop making them into these kind of villainous, you don't want to make them Bane. You don't want to make them into, you know, the Joker. You don't want to make them anybody that somebody could look at and say, this is cool. You know, people talk about like wanting to achieve high scores over others. And I'm going, you know, I'm wondering if we should maybe have more focus on some of the negative aspects of their life. Like, okay, great. How long did this guy wet the bed if he was, you know, and just try to make this less something, because the media wants to sort of push these guys as the biggest, scariest thing ever, when perhaps we should be having more of a focus on trying to make them pathetic or trying to make them, you know, in some ways, a post-mortem humiliation might be a better way to go about it.
I mean, look, I can tell you that with Portapique, you did not hear that name very often, and there were lively, real debates within newsrooms that are not about how can we make the story as big as possible. It's hard to imagine a bigger story. But reporters responsibly trying to balance the public's right to know what the hell just happened, and people have a right to know, and we represent that right to know. And also very much keeping these issues in mind. We are in a very difficult position in the media. The lack of detail in reporting on something like Portapique opens the door for the RCMP to write their own narrative about what happened. And so we do want to give timelines. We do want to explain it. We do want to speak to newsreaders and audiences who just want to know why, how. Is there anything that we can do to stop this from happening again? And invariably, that does take you into the specifics, especially when you start talking about accomplices or where the firearms came from, the role of the loved ones. How do you tell that story when you're anonymizing things to that degree? These are live debates in newsrooms. And I do think there's been a very big shift in the tone of coverage. What I don't know is what impact that has had in preventing copycats or contagions, because the real new factor and the audience that these guys are often playing to is their online community. And sure, it's a nice feather in the cap if you are the big scary bad guy on the nightly news, but they are live streaming these things for their fan bases. They are leaving their manifestos in specific places on the internet. And that is the sense of community or legacy or infamy that they're playing to. And I think that, you know, all we can do there is have law enforcement looking for those people, because often they do announce their intentions before they strike.
And I think the Canadian media has been more responsible with it, although I would push back on the RCMP still has largely been able to write a lot of the narrative in ways that benefit the RCMP and harm public understanding. But one of the big problems that we have is that Canada as a country is a fairly small country next to our neighbor. And we get tons of our media through the filter of the U.S. media. And the U.S. has taken a much less responsible approach to it.
Hi, I'm Yvonne. This is clearly a very divisive issue that, you know, leads to deepening the line between rural and urban voters, left and right, and all of that. And in these exceptionally polarized times, I see it as not only an irresponsible waste of money, but potentially just directly harmful to the fabric of Canadian society. The reality is most urban dwellers have never been around a gun, have never held a gun, haven't grown up in an environment where guns are part of the culture, part of their tradition, part of their way of life. Nobody in the city really hunts unless they're very wealthy and can afford to travel to hunt for recreation rather than for subsistence. Whereas in rural communities, they're a way of life, and they're an invaluable tool. You use them to protect your livestock, you use them to hunt for food, which in my opinion is the most ethical way of sourcing meat that's available to us. I mean, unfortunately, these high-profile mass killings do happen, and the reality is that a motivated enough killer is going to commit this kind of crime with the tools they have available. Now, semi-automatic weapons certainly are an effective way of doing that kind of crime, but also look at the five, let's say, high-profile mass killings in Canada that have happened in recent memory. Two of them have been not involving guns at all. I mean, it sounds callous to say almost, but the reality is that these kinds of mass killing events are statistically an outlier. These aren't a threat to your average Canadian on a daily basis.
But it's not that mass shooting is such a huge regular issue here, and it still is at historic high levels in the States and is a blight on their society. And because we inhale whatever they exhale, I don't want that to become Canada. Ian, why should we not do everything we can to stop that from happening?
The thing is, in terms of public policy, everything is a give and take. Every dollar we spend on these bans, and I mean, these bans, I don't think have anything to do with the current government having a pursuit of public safety. They have a lot to do with the current government having a policy of, we think that we are struggling for the next election, and we think that this is a better issue to run on. But
come on, that's just a completely, I'll be the first to say that there are political intentions behind everything they do, but why would you question that they don't want more mass shootings? Of course they want fewer mass shootings. Why wouldn't they?
I don't think that this bothers them one way or another, except other than they think that this is a place where the Conservative Party is weak. That's really the driving goal here. But in terms of whether or not this is going to save lives, this is going to cost